All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon, people. The people or the person you're listening to is not Dale Thronberry. Dale has been called out of town on a family emergency, and he's asked myself and Michael Smith to fill in today's program. We are also missing Air Force General Anne Fasson. She is from Legal Help for Veterans and who's in Ireland this week. My name is Vance McCrum, better known as the Dog Man. I was an Air Force dog handler in Vietnam in 1965. I could tell you about my dog, but I would just bore you to death. Sitting across from me is Michael Smith. Mike, why don't you tell us about your history?
Well, Vance, it's good to be here on the show with you today. And, of course, our thoughts and prayers are with Dale and his family at this time. I'm the director of Washtenaw County Department of Veterans Affairs. I've been in that particular department of county government for over 25 years now, and I've been with the county for a little bit over, I've been in the department for 22 years, and I've been with the county for over 26 years. I joined the United States Army in 1983 at the tender young age of 17 and did my basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I was an offset press operator for my first 4 years, assigned to a psychological operations unit at Fort Bragg, where we printed propaganda and did fun things like go to Grenada and Panama and things like that. And then I changed my military occupational skill to M1 Abrams, tank crew member, and was on an M1 for about 2 years, and then I changed to my MOS to personnel, and then was on active duty for 8 years and really loved it and was a part of the drawdown after the first Gulf War, where we were mandated to draw down the armed forces and specifically the Army because we were the largest component at that time. And I had the privilege and the honor of continuing my service in the U.S. Army National Guard in North Carolina and here in Michigan. And then toward the end of my career, I was able to switch over to the reserves. And so I had, the distinct privilege of serving in all three components of the U.S. Army, active, National Guard, and Reserve, and I retired from my military service with 21 years back in April of 2004.
You have a storied service helping veterans, obviously, from what I've heard here. My brief history in the military is I joined the Air Force, I pre-enlisted in the Air Force my senior year in high school in 1961. Is when I pre-enlisted, and I discharged in 62, and I took 6 months off from high school because I knew and be able to sleep till noon because at some point that was going to go away. and I was inducted into the Air Force in January 1963, obviously sent down to Lackland Air Force Base, Texas, where I went through basic training in Air Police School, which is now called, I believe, Security Police School. And marched down to the sentry dog school, and they marched our platoon down there, and we watched those folks put on a demonstration for us. Then they asked for volunteers, and that looked like something I'd like to do, and so I raised my hand and had to go through a two-step interview process with the one of the instructors down there and one of the NCOICs in charge of the school, and was accepted, and it was another 2 months there at Lackland. And then I was sent to my primary base in Aldous Air Force Base, Oklahoma, which was a B-52 base at the time. And they were just phasing out their missiles that were strategically placed around the air base when I got there. And my dog Casey and I went to Lackland Air Force, or from Lackland to Aldous Air Force Base on a train. and that's where we went and spent my time there. They asked for volunteers for Vietnam in early 65, and in 1965, Vietnam wasn't on the news, and I really didn't know much about what was going on there, but myself and another buddy of mine, we raised our hands, and off we went to Lackland to get evaluated as handlers and our dogs, and then shipped off to Vietnam. I want to remind everybody listening to today's program that today's program is about your benefits. And if you have any questions, please give us a call, 734-822. Let me do that again, 734-822-1600. Again, that's 734-822-1600. Michael, you want to take over who the program is brought to you by?
Well, absolutely. We're really proud to have Legal Help for Veterans as the sponsor of the show. And Legal Help for Veterans concentrates only on veterans' disability claims. They have a wonderful staff there. And if you need help, if you feel like you have run out of options, please consider Legal Help for Veterans. Again, a great staff they have there. In addition, we're also sponsored today by Vietnam Veterans of America, the Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310 out of Ann Arbor, the Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 423 of Ann Arbor, and American Legion Post 46 also of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and of course, the U.S. Wings, makers of the finest military and bomber jackets anywhere. And joining us on the line right now is the founder and CEO of U.S. Wings, Sergeant David Hack. Welcome back to Veterans Radio, Sarge.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on as a guest. It's quite an honor, and listening to all you guys' history really makes me proud of you. Well, I started out myself in 1956 in the National Guard, and from there I went into the Coast Guard, and I was in the Coast Guard for 4 years. And then from the Coast Guard, by the way, I stayed seasick for 4 years. And then from the Coast Guard, I joined the Army. And when I walked into the Army recruiter, he says, what branch of service were you in there, young man? Because I do have tattoos on my arms. And I said, Coast Guard. He says, sit down. And he says, how would you like to become an Army Ranger? And I says, well, I don't know anything about Army Rangers, but sounds good. So I immediately went to Fort Benning, Georgia. I walked into Fort Benning, and the first sergeant there says, Coast Guard, huh? And I says, yes, sir. And he says, well, I work for a living. You know, I'm a sergeant. And I didn't know what that meant then. And he says, okay. He says, what we're going to do is you're not going to go through school. You're going to teach school. We're sending you to Eglin Air Force Base. That's the jungle school for the United States Army Rangers. And I says, wow, okay. So I went direct to Eglin Air Force Base, Field 5 and Field 7, and I was a ranger instructor. Back then, that's what they called us. Now they call them trainers. And I stayed there for 2 years. And then from there, I went into special assignment for the Army Rangers up in Newfoundland. And then from there, I went to Vietnam in 1968. And I'm very familiar with dog handlers, by the way. My commanding officer, which was General Keith Ware, had a dog donated to him by the Air Force. And the dog's name was King. And Major General Ware, if you pull up on the Internet about Major General Keith Ware, he was quite a person. He fought alongside Audie Murphy. Major General Ware was killed Friday the 13th, September 1968, in a helicopter direct hit. When he was killed with the direct hit, I was on a track at the time. I was supposed to meet him there. And I received a direct hit, and I stayed in the hospital for, a year at Ireland Army Hospital at Fort Knox. And then from there, I was on medical hold, and I was placed as a recruiter. I stayed as a recruiter from 1969 to 73. Then from there, I went in law enforcement. I was a police officer. I was the chief of police. And then my wife and I started U.S. Wings. And what a neat business it is. And that's what this is all about. We are also the licensee for the Purple Heart Foundation. And we also have a retail store in Hudson, Ohio. And we also supply all branches of service with their bomber jackets. And we also supply the civilian population throughout the world with bomber jackets. And we have the largest repair facility in the world for bomber jackets and flight jackets. And it's a very exciting business. It really is. And back to the VA. If I still have time, I'd like to discuss that just a short moment. Whenever I was discharged from the Army, I went to a guy, his name was Chris Noble, and he was with the VA. And I told him, I says, Chris, you know, I don't have a lot of money, but I want to buy a house. And he says, sit down. We'll help you. And Chris Noble was at the Cleveland VA office, and he bent over backwards. And the VA not only helped me, they put me in a home. And I'll tell you what, my hats are off to the VA 100%. And I'm really, really impressed by their professionalism and how they bend over backwards to help a veteran.
That's very nice. Sarge, can these jackets be ordered with unit patches?
We can, but we have to make sure of the sizes. And that's what it's all about. We like to have a person reach out to us and say, hey, look, this is my height and weight. We're about 95% spot on when it comes to sizing if they give us that information. Sometimes a guy will order a jacket and he tries it on, then he sends it back to us and we put the patches on. But we have a full facility for patches, leather name tags, the whole nine yards. We are a high-end company. Most of the presidents of the United States wear our jackets. FlexJet, a private jet company. They have an ungodly number of jets out and about. We supply them. We supply most of the movies, the aviation movies. We supply just about all federal agencies. And whenever you see a bomber jacket, if it's the real deal, it is a U.S. Wings jacket.
Sarge, would you give us your website?
It's uswings.com, www.uswings.com. We've been in business since 1986, and we are a defense logistics agency vendor. We are a defense agency supplier, and like I said, we are definitely a Purple Heart Foundation licensee, and there's only three of us, and we're the only one in the apparel business. There's Mardavi Wine. I think there's a guy out there, General Motors, floating around, and U.S. Wings. And,
very nice. I have a sweatshirt that Dale Thronberry and Gary Lilly, if you remember Gary, brought back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, brought back from your store down there in Northeast Ohio, a sweatshirt and a T-shirt that I break out of the mothballs in my dresser and put it on and wear it occasionally. And I was going to wear it today, but you can't see it on the radio, so I didn't put it on for today's show. Well, Sarge, I appreciate the call. I hope this visit here with us will generate some more business your way, and we'll let you go, sir.
Well, before you go, one thing. U.S. Wings has a reputation of giving back to our veterans.
And that's correct.
That is a fact.
That is a fact, and we certainly do appreciate it.
All right, brother, you have a good one, and welcome home.
Yes, sir, welcome home.
See you, Sarge. Bye. And remember, Sarge has been committed to giving away one of his bomber jackets at the end of each of these shows on the benefits. And, of course, Dale will let us know a little bit later who the winner is going to be today.
Yeah, somehow I don't know how that's going to happen, but he's going to let us know.
So, Sarge, people may have heard about some of the rumblings of new things going on with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Of course, the Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act was signed into law by President Trump in August of 2017 with full implementation of that law going into effect again in February of 2019. So that's exactly what happened.
This guy's out of here.
We can talk about that a little bit later after we talk to our caller, okay, if we have a caller. But, I'll go over what the Appeals Modernization Act is all about in the full implementation that went into effect on February 19th, 2019.
Will, this is Vance talking to you here. I'm glad you called in. Could you go ahead and repeat your question? We've got Michael Smith here, our resident experts on benefits.
Okay. My name is Will, and I live in this real small town called St. Mary's, Missouri. It's in the middle of nowhere. Here's my dilemma. I'm receiving aid and attendance for 1881, but I wonder if it's worth it for me to even pursue my case. I have military sexual trauma. All the paperwork that I have here is quite confusing. I've got an appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals. I don't know whether I should just list PTSD or military sexual trauma or what it is I should do. It's like I think I need a lawyer because a friend of mine says, well, can you speak for yourself? And I said, I don't think so because I'm in stage four, which is anger. That's not that my perpetrator. He's got a Facebook page, and I saw his face, and I was like, oh, God, there he is. So how can you help me?
So when you say you're receiving aid and attendance, are you so you're receiving the non-service-connected disability pension based on the need for aid and attendance?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's 1881, I guess, just due to my whatever it is I have now, a broken right leg and Alzheimer's disease and dementia, PTSD, military sexual trauma.
Okay. Blah, blah, blah. So most military sexual traumas are unreported, and the VA knows that, and so they had to come up with rules for processing those claims where they do an extensive review of your service personnel record and service treatment records to identify if there are any markers or indicators in those records that could substantiate that a military sexual trauma happened. And yes, typically military sexual trauma is not a disorder itself. It's the event that actually precipitates the development of a mental health disorder, and typically it is post-traumatic stress disorder, but people also develop major depressive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder, or they can get all quite a few mental health disorders as a result of that. And what we try to do when we take a look at a military sexual trauma case is we look at those records, and what the VA is going to look at also are things like a change in your evaluations from being a stellar sailor, Marine, Coast Guardist, air personnel, or soldier, and all of a sudden you're getting bad evaluations, or sudden requests for a change in unit, or getting involved with non-judicial punishment or judicial punishment, whether it's with civilian or military authorities, because now something's going on behaviorally as a result of the military sexual trauma. And that's what the VA does with these kinds of claims because, again, they know most people don't report it. Now, if it was reported, then they go to the provost marshal and they try to find the security police or the military police reports or unit reports that could substantiate that something happened. So I don't know where you are in your claims process. You mentioned that you had an appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals, and I'm not certain if that's for that claim or if it's for a different claim.
Yeah, it's for that claim, and they, you know, just have all this wording in here. It says, yes, he does have military sexual trauma. Yes, he has PTSD, but no, it's not service connected. So it's like, it says the examiner, indicated that stressor one and two, you reported depressed mood, anxiety, suspiciousness, chronic sleep impairment, flattened affect, disturbance of motivation and mood, difficulty in maintaining effective work and social relationship. It says, my case is highly complex, involves conflicting information, highly inaccurate overlapping conditions, and an interface of mental health and legal history. It says, the examiner noted that you have a verified and credible diagnosis of PTSD. It is impossible to apportion specific symptoms of PTSD or impairment related to PTSD to a specific sexual trauma. Appears to your PTSD did exist prior to your military service. as while you were on several jobs and completed high school, you did get fired from one job. Your condition was significantly worsened as a result of that. Anyway, what happened was this really did happen, and what I did was I was stationed in Galena, Alaska between, well, it was during 1973, and then in, when I got out of there, I went to report it to a captain, and he said, it was a psychiatrist, and he said, if you mention anything about having any kind of sexual relationships with a man in the service, you will be dishonorably discharged. So I just shut my mouth and walked out. And, you know, and thank God I got an honorable discharge. I mean, this paperwork just blows my mind. It's like, who do I call?
You made the appeal, or are you working with a veteran service organization to help you with your claim, like the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, or Disabled American Veterans?
Yeah, I've been calling the American Legion. They're not. This guy is not in. And someone told me that I just have to keep calling him all the time. So I guess I just wait till I finally get he answers my call and then go see him, make an appointment to see him. Is that how I should do it?
Yes, I would highly recommend that you continue to work with your service officer. They're going to be able to understand that language in that rating decision. They're going to, and it is. There's a lot of legalese that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs puts into a rating decision, but the bottom line is, why did they deny the claim? Was it because the examiner said that it wasn't related to a stressor, or was it because they couldn't identify any markers or indicators? They'll give you a reason why they deny the claim, and it's kind of hidden in all that other language, but they do actually get to it. And that's what your service officer should focus on, because if it's an issue of evidence or something else that that person can turn around, then that's what their role is as an advocate to assist you.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's my question. I know the medic gave me, it was either Valium or Xanax, I can't remember, because I was anxious about being in a remote spot. But shouldn't there be some kind of, I mean, could he just give me those pills and not have written it down? I mean, is that even possible back in the 70s?
Well, you would think that if someone's dispensing medication that they would write a prescription, and that would be of record in your service treatment records. And again, that's a very important indicator or marker that the VA would look for to, again, verify that something was going on with you, especially if it's anxiety.
Yeah, well, they said that the only indication they have from him is that he gave me a food handler's card. And it's like, that's not all that happened here. You know, and I've got letters from my friend, and, you know, I don't know how many times I've been, you know, in mental hospitals and things like that. It's just, I mean, this whole thing has just ruined my life.
Yeah, it typically does. It's very horrible. Incidents that happen, and I've worked with a lot of claimants, and I'm working with one right now, and the VA basically denied the claim because they said that there were no markers in the personnel record that would indicate that something had happened. And I had to comb through those service personnel records, and it was like, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack. But I found, because I was a former personnel sergeant, what I thought would be very important markers, and we reopened the claim after getting an opinion from the person's treating psychiatrist at the VA after reviewing those records that I identified. And she basically said, yes, these are actual markers or indicators to me of the change in the person's behavior. So a lot of times these claims need really good medical evidence. They need somebody who's committed to looking at those personnel records and looking at those service treatment records and trying to find those very small details that the VA is looking for, and then bringing it to their attention so that you can kind of make their jobs a little easier. And they appreciate us for doing that, and that's the reason why I would, again, strongly encourage you to get a hold of your American Legion service officer and have that person help you in the same way. That's what their job is. They're the advocate for you, and veterans out there in the community and survivors who can't understand a lot of that language that the VA uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's real confusing. Very confusing. Okay. All right, so your recommendation then is just keep working with him, make an appointment, see him, and have him go over all this paperwork.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, God bless you. And
same to you.
You know, to all other veterans that had this happen, you know, they say, I belong to this group that says 1 in 6 men have been abused. And I think that, you know, from being in all these hospitals, I think it's more than that. I think it's more like 2 in 6. It's just that we don't talk about it, you know, but I don't care. I'll talk about it now. I'm sick of hiding all this stuff, you know. It's like, you know, nobody should have to go through this. I didn't sign up to be molested and that, you know, and my whole life messed up.
Well, as you can hear in the background, we're coming up on a hard break. Will, we do appreciate your call, and I do hope that Michael was able to help you get your problems resolved. He's a man with a lot of knowledge, and we appreciate it. Thanks for the call, Will.
You're quite welcome. God bless you.
Thank you. We're back. That Medal of Honor segment was brought to you by the American Legion Post 46 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Michael, could you go back to your topic that you were talking about initially?
Oh, absolutely. Again, the Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act was signed into law in August of 2017. And what it does is basically streamlines the appeals process that many people are familiar with, that it's a long, lengthy process. And one of the reasons why is because when you're engaging with the VA about an appeal in the former legacy system, the record was never considered closed. And as long as the record is open, and then the reason why we that's an issue is you want to retain that earlier effective date once the VA makes the right decision, and that could be 6 years or 7 years or however long it takes the appeal. But what happens with this new new lanes by which a person can appeal decisions. After February 19th, 2019, the full implementation of the Appeals Modernization Act went into effect, and the old legacy system of appeals is actually going to be phased out. The VA had to create new forms. So the old forms, the VA form 21-0958, which is a notice of disagreement, and the VA form 9, which is the substantive appeal to perfect the appeal, those all went away. And the forms that are being used now are the ones that allows the person to select which one of the three lanes they would like to use for their appeal. So now the people may have been familiar with the higher level review lane and the supplemental claim lane, because those were a part of the VA's initial implementation of this new law in the interim period between 2017 and February of 2019, and they label it the Rapid Appeals Management Program, or RAMP, where they were reaching out to veterans and giving them the option to opt into the Rapid Appeals Management Program. And the only two lanes that were available to them during that program were the Supplemental Claim Lane and the Higher Level Review Lane. What went into effect on the 19th of February was the decision review request, or the appeal directly to the Board of Appeals. So what's different about that is the higher level review is where you ask another person who is a little bit more experienced, typically a decision review officer or a hearing officer or a VA employee who has a lot more experience, to review the decision that was rendered. In the higher level review lane, you're not allowed to add any additional evidence. Basically, you believe that the claim is solid, the decision maker who denied the claim or gave you an inappropriate evaluation just was not experienced enough to apply the facts of the law and the facts of the case correctly. So the higher level review is, again, a more experienced VA employee who is going to review the claim, and it's a de novo review where they can actually overturn and render an entirely new decision. Now, the new form that goes along with that is the new VA form 20-0996. Again, the decision review request for a higher level review is a new VA form 20-0996. Now, the supplemental claim lane is another new means by which people can appeal decisions of the VA. But under the supplemental claim lane, you can add additional evidence to the record. So that new form is a new VA form 20-0995.
Now, is this new? Could you, in the past, you couldn't add new evidence?
Oh, you could add new evidence. And that was one of the reasons why there was this back and forth in the old legacy system with the old appeals process. When you filed a notice of disagreement, you could add additional evidence. When the VA issued the statement of the case, you read the statement of the case, you had a certain amount of time to respond. If you added additional evidence at that point, they would issue you a supplemental statement of the case. And then they would order additional exams if you requested additional exams. And all this new material was being assembled before, and then they give you one last opportunity to add more evidence, and then they would certify the appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals. And if it went to the Board of Veterans Appeals, there's two things that could happen. They could remand the entire case back to the regional office and say, hey, listen, you failed to get this veteran an exam, you failed to get this piece of evidence, you failed to give this, send this administrative letter. And the remand instructions from the Board of Veterans Appeals would then almost essentially allow people to continue to add more and more evidence. And the more evidence you add, that's how much more time the VA had to give you, 60 days here, 90 days here. And that, again, is why that old legacy system took so long. So what's new is if you request a higher level review, you cannot add additional evidence.
Okay.
If you ask for a supplemental claim lane, you can add additional evidence. And lastly, the other means by which you can appeal a decision now is a decision review request where you appeal directly to the Board of Veteran Appeals. So what that means is it does not go to Detroit, which is the regional office of jurisdiction for us here in Michigan. This form goes directly to Washington, D.C., to the Board of Veterans Appeals, and you can fax it to them. Now, what's neat about these three new lanes are the times. The VA is basically saying that those who select the higher level review lane and the supplemental claim lane, on average, it's going to take about 125 days to get a different decision. And the direct appeal to the Board of Veteran Appeals is going to take 365 days.
On top of the 125.
Well, so if they go directly to the BVA, okay, it's 1 year.
Yeah.
Now, here's the neat thing. You can go for a decision review, a higher level review, excuse me, and in 125 days, if they uphold the decision, you can switch over to the supplemental claim lane, add additional evidence, another 125 days, and let's say it doesn't get satisfied there, then they can appeal directly to the Board of Veteran Appeals. But either way, you're looking still less than 2 years if you use all three lanes, whereas before you were looking at years and years, 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 years.
It's quite apparent to me, listening to Mike talk about the appeals process, that it's very important that you veterans use your resources for you to make this end run around them and get your process going. I know when I first filed a claim for my hearing problems, it was rejected, and my the guy who was running it for me was Dr. Martinez, and he appealed it, and then it was it took a year, but I did get my hearing aids, but I suffered for a while waiting for that to happen. So it's important that we follow through with these, with the right folks to do this.
You're absolutely right. We always encourage veterans or survivors or dependents to work with an accredited county veteran service officer or an accredited service officer from any of our national veteran service organizations, such as the VFW, the Marine Corps League, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans. They really know VA rules, regulations, law, process these procedures, and yes, all these different forms that the VA creates for us to use, and they will reject you if you don't use the proper form. They'll actually send you a bad boy letter or a bad girl letter and saying, hey, listen, this law that went into effect so many years ago says that we have to use standardized forms, and if we can't accept it if it's not on a standard form, but they'll be nice enough to enclose the right form for you. Yes, and then speaking of our service organization partners, there is a new VA Form 21-22, which is the appointment of a veterans service organization as claimant's representative. The VA went from a one-page form and created two pages now, and I'm not real certain what they did in here. They added items 1-9 to identify how the representative is going to help the person.
Yeah. What possessed you to continue your career as working to helping veterans?
Well, when I got out of the U.S. Army, I wanted to work in government. There's just something about working in government that was appealed to me. I felt like it was an extension of my military service to be able to serve and help other people. And I got started in Washtenaw County, and going and using my vocational rehabilitation benefits and my Montgomery GI Bill benefits, I started studying public administration and political science. Felt like that was a good college degree to prepare a person to work in government. And as I continued to work, and I didn't think about even working for the VA, what happened was I was working as an internal consultant to county departments as we were rolling out what was called our business improvement process back when Bob Gunzel was the county administrator here in Washtenaw County. And we also came up with a new professional development program. And so I was a resource planner. And one of the other resource planners, again, we were trained by consultants that were helping us with this kind of the reengineering of our of the county government and getting out of entrenched government and trying to be more of a world-class service provider. And the other person that was working along with me was a former Air Force veteran by the name of Walter McGuire, who worked for the Friend of the Court. And as we were divvying up departments, we all had to consult five of the Washtenaw County departments. And so we were the only two veterans, and we thought, well, we should do the presentation to the Veteran Services Office. So I made contact with the former director of the office, Mark Linke, and we did their professional development plans and talked to them about the business improvement process. And so one of the things we had to do is look at their business units and see were they fully staffed and what was their budget. And I noticed they had a vacancy. And so one of our recommendations was for his office to meet its efficiencies, he should probably fill that vacancy. That's the vacancy that I applied for when he posted the position. And I tell you what, I found my fit in government. And it was, for me, more of a passion than it was a job. It's when I can sit down and across the table from another veteran or a survivor or dependent and know that the knowledge that I have and knowing the processes and procedures and knowing how to beat the VA and then beating the VA is a life-transforming thing for those other comrades in arms. And there's no greater reward than to be able to change someone's life in that way.
It's quite apparent that this is not a job for you.
No, sir. No, not at all, Vance. I tell you what, there's a lot of shouting and screaming and running up and down the halls in our department when we beat the VA and one of our vets gets a $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000 retroactive payment. In some cases, I remember when one of our vets, we went all the way back and we found what was called a clear and unmistakable error that when they rated his gunshot wounds, they only rated the scars in the front. They didn't rate the exit wounds. So his award went all the way back to his first rating in 1957, and he got a $431,000 retroactive payment.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know that's a life-transforming event for someone.
Yeah, folks, we have got about 10 or 12 minutes left. As you can tell, this program this evening is about your benefits, your veterans' benefits. Please give us a call on 734-822-1600. We've got the lines are open, so we could go for some more questions.
And as you can see, when the VA makes these changes, of course, that's why Will and others like him and are a little confused about processes and procedures because the VA will change the laws and the rules, and the people that know about that are accredited veteran service officers because we have to stay abreast and of the changes, the new processes, new procedures. Matter of fact, I'll mention another pretty interesting case. It was Procopio, versus Wilkie. It was a Federal Circuit Court of Appeals decision on the 29th of January, 2019, where the circuit court basically said, hey, listen, when Congress wrote the law and said that a person was going to be presumed exposed to herbicide agents like Agent Orange, they basically said that they had to have service in the Republic of Vietnam. And they basically said the stepping foot on the ground was not necessarily a requirement to be deemed as having service in the Republic of Vietnam, because they went into some serious definitions about what that meant. And they said it doesn't only mean the landmass of any country, but it also includes the nautical waters or the nautical seas surrounding it, out to 12 nautical miles. And so they basically said that any of those Blue Water Navy veterans who were within 12 nautical miles of the Republic of Vietnam had service in the Republic of Vietnam for the presumption of exposure to herbicides. So that's going to the VA, again, I may have mentioned in the last show, has 90 days to appeal that decision. If they don't appeal it, or they do appeal it and the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to hear it, then it's going to become a precedent-setting case. That means that the VA is going to now have to extend the presumption of exposure to our Blue Water Navy vets, which is about 90,000 veterans out there, and untold number of survivors who would now be eligible for benefits under the Agent Orange Act.
Yeah, I remember reading about that a few weeks ago, and I clapped my hands. Can you tell us a little about VA care?
Well, I'll tell you what, speaking of care, one of the other things that the VA just did is they just proposed their rules for the new veteran community care that was a part of the Mission Act, and this is an extension of the CHOICE program, and I believe there's about 90 days of response time that people can write in and give their input on how those new rules should look. But basically, VA healthcare is not an insurance. VA is an actual healthcare provider. And that's, I think, where most people are confused in thinking that, well, you know, I go to the VA and therefore I'm covered. You are for treatment, and yet it's not portable. What's going to happen with this new CHOICE program is that it is going to be a lot more portable. If the VA, number one, can't provide a particular service, then they're going to allow you to go out on the economy. Yet those providers are going to be vetted by the VA, and there's going to be a specific list that you can go see. So it's not like you can go see your own provider. It will be someone that the VA has already vetted, kind of like a Medicare, Medicare-approved doctor. Similarly, if there's this 40-mile rule or 30-days rule that is always been in consideration, you know, like if you live outside of a 40-mile radius, then you might be able to take advantage of CHOICE, or if the VA can't get an appointment for you within 30 days, then you might have the opportunity for CHOICE. But as a veteran who uses the VA Ann Arbor healthcare system, I really am happy about my own care. My primary care physician, Dr. Lei Ung, is top-notch. Her nursing staff and support staff on the red team are a great group of folks. They stay after you. They send you letters. They send you text message reminders of your appointments. They send you a little appointment card. So they really do care, and it's I'm glad. And I think I've said this before. I'm really glad that I've established my health care with the VA.
Yeah, we're fortunate here in Southeast Michigan to have the Ann Arbor VA Hospital, which I consider to be one of the finest in the nation.
It is.
And a lot of that, obviously, is a result of its location, its proximity to the University of Michigan and St. Joe Hospitals, but they still provide great care here in Ann Arbor.
I had a lot of veterans who they moved out to Colorado, a couple have moved to Arizona, one moved to Virginia to take a job working for the company, and all four or five of those veterans that I've known who moved out of the state, they fly back to Ann Arbor to get their health care here still.
Yeah, at Christmas time, our VVA chapter, Charles S. Kettles chapter 310, we have a program where we go up to the VA during Christmas and hand out gifts, and we frequently will be talking to patients in there that are from out of state or reasonably close to another VA hospital, but they opt to come here to Ann Arbor for their care.
It is a testament to the fine work that the previous directors and the current director, Ms. Kreisman, has done, Dr. Kreisman has done to make that facility one of the top facilities in the nation.
Yeah, yeah, it is a really nice facility. What's the average time to file a claim, and assuming that there's no need for appeals or anything like that to happen?
What we're seeing right now is, so when we formalize a claim, and what I mean by formalize a claim, there's two ways in which we do this. If we know we're going to need to get evidence together, opinions from doctors, secure records, what we do is we fill out an intent to file. And what that basically does is it puts the VA on notice and says, hey, listen, I intend to file a formal claim here. And then they give you 1 year from the date of that intent to get the formal claim submitted. So once we get that formal claim in, we're looking at standard processing times right now between 100 and 120 days.
Really? Wow, that's good.
It is very good.
That's very good.
And what you get with an accredited county veteran service officer or an accredited service organization representative is we all have remote access to the VA computing systems. So Veterans Benefits Management System, or VBMS, is the where the VA stores the electronic folder, the former C file, if you remember that. They did have those big brown folders that was a triple fold folder. They've gotten rid of all their paper and essentially have uploaded and scanned all those files into the Veterans Benefits Management System and created an electronic record. But it's also their claims processing software. So I can literally look in VBMS on a daily basis and see where my claim is. And they're moving it around in what's called the National Work Queue, and I call it the iCloud. And it's kind of neat because the VA is saying, listen, instead of your claim sitting in Detroit for the establishment of the claim and then sitting on somebody's desk waiting for somebody to do initial development of the claim and then waiting for somebody to rate the claim and then waiting for somebody to generate the award and then promulgate the rules, because they're so busy, it's kind of making its way through the snake very slowly. So what they're doing with the National Work Queue is they'll send it to Detroit to establish the claim, and then it goes into the National Work Queue, and then the National Work Queue moves it to the next station that has capacity to work that claim at the next stage within days. So the claims are getting moved around electronically. There's no problem. They used to do this before called brokered work, where they would pack up the old Brown C files and boxes and mail them off to a site that had capacity to do rating or development. And obviously, you know, things would get lost, or, you know, because it's paper, it would get damaged. So right now, the VA is very, very efficient in how they're doing their work and moving the claims around electronically. And that's the reason why we're seeing these expedited processing times.
I think the key word you used early in your explanation to my question was accredited service officers.
Yes.
Without those men or women doing that, you could spend untold hours doing it, going nowhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. Your accredited service officers from the National Veteran Service Organizations, like the DAV, American Legion, the VFW, Marine Corps League, Military Order of Purple Heart, Paralyzed Veterans of America, Vietnam Veterans of America, is you're getting a person, again, that has to maintain their accreditation by obtaining continuing education units each year. Our association, which is the National Association of County Veteran Service Officers, requires us to obtain 16 continuing education units per year to maintain our accreditations. Well, what you're getting is those people who are teaching those classes are from central office, from the VA, or they're from the regional office in Detroit. So we're getting VA employees that are basically conducting our training so that we stay abreast of these new law changes, the new changes in any regulations, new forms, processes and procedures. And then, of course, we talk amongst ourselves and we troubleshoot problems that we all run into when we're dealing with helping a veteran or a survivor or dependent file claims with the VA, and we're able to help each other. And that networking amongst county veteran service officers or other accredited veteran service officers is the key to the success of a lot of veterans and survivors and dependents getting their benefits.
Yeah. I'm just about out of questions, Michael. My brother called me 3 years ago, and he's a two-tour veteran in Vietnam. And he says his primary doctor just told him he had type 2 diabetes. And so I got him in touch. He lives up in the Lansing area. So I got him in touch with a veteran service group up in the Lansing area. And this was like 3 years ago. And it was almost a year to the day when he started getting his veterans benefits checks.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's good.
And he called me when he first got that, and I says, you owe me dinner.
Well, the most important thing is making that connection to a person that can walk you through the process.
Yep.
Diabetes and most of your presumptive conditions related to exposure to herbicides, we used to call those a slam dunk claim. The VA can't get those wrong.
Right.
They verify you're in Vietnam. They see you've got a diagnosis of diabetes or prostate cancer or Parkinson's disease. It's pretty much a slam dunk. If they deny that claim,
yeah,
that's an easy one to win.
That's where your eyes get real wide.
Oh, I get real wide. No, well, I get pretty upset when they make a mistake like that.
And I guess the reason I mentioned that is the fact that my brother belonged to a VFW post, but he was not aware that type 2 diabetes was covered. And there's veterans out there today that may even be listening to this program who aren't aware.
Yeah, there's quite a few medical conditions related to herbicide exposure, and there's five being considered to be added to that list. And one of them, of course, is bladder cancer, which is for many years people thought, hey, how does the cancer get to your prostate, but it doesn't get to your bladder. And we've always wondered about that, even with respiratory cancers, like there's a cancer of the trachea is one, but cancer of the esophagus is not.
Right.
They're right next to each other. You know, when I know one goes to the lungs and the other one goes to your stomach, but we always get confused about how the VA arrives or how the Institute of Medicine and some of these people that are studying herbicide exposure and what medical conditions it causes in the body, how they can arrive at one cancer or one condition and overlook another. But hypertension is another one of the new five. Parkinson's-like disease or Parkinson's-like symptoms is another one. And so we're hoping that the secretary will add the five new conditions because it's just deserving that, you know, people. I look at our Vietnam veterans, and I have the utmost respect. My it's just funny, as we were talking, I saw my phone ring, and then it's my Uncle Lester, who was a Vietnam veteran, and my Uncle Ron, both went to Vietnam. And, I sit there and I think about how a person sees some of the most horrifying things that you can experience in warfare. And you get home and you go, doggone it, I made it. And then 30 years later, prostate cancer or diabetes or one of these weird things, and you go, doggone.
Yeah, my brother-in-law was an Army combat tracker, and that was another form of military dog use in Vietnam. And he had – go ahead, Mike. You got an announcement.
Hey, I got a winner for the Wings jacket. It would be James O'Brien out of Dover, Delaware. My understanding is he completed basic training at Lackland Air Force Base, located in Bexar County, Texas, in 1993. James O'Brien, Dover, Delaware, is a winner of the U.S. Wings jacket. Make sure you email Dale Throneberry all of your information so he can coordinate getting that jacket to you.
Michael Smith, please, thank you so much for making me sit here in this hot seat. So much enjoyable. And ladies and gentlemen, you are now dismissed.